Well, the theme for this morning is obedience. Not a very fashionable word, I think, these days. It may have different connotations for all of us. But to be honest, I think it's a challenge from the get-go, isn't it? Obedience. From the age of about 9 months old, when our thinking brain starts to come online and we realise we can do our own thing, starts to go a bit awry from there. And I can remember, I must have been about five, and my mum clearly had to go shopping to get some stuff. Nobody else to look after me at home, so I had to go as well. I can't remember what I was playing or doing at the time, but I didn't want to go. And I remember trailing along meters behind her, very sulkily and sort of dawdling, and a mum turning around and saying, come on, this is going to take twice as long if you carry on like that, you know, and don't be naughty and all this thing. And I just carried on dragging and dragging. And she less and less looked behind to see if I was coming. And so something just went into my brain one time, I'm going to turn and run for home. And so I did. I just turned heels, ran along the road towards home. By the time Mum looked round, I was quite a way down the road, and she was hurrying along after me. I think the reason why it's still in my brain, that memory, is because when she caught up with me, it was not particularly pretty. And I don't think I ever did it again. But, you know, I think there are times when we're following along with God in life, and it's tempting just to say, do you know what? I'm going to go in the other direction. I don't want to follow on like this anymore. I'm not going to do that. And today, we're going to have two testimonies from Pauline and Christine, two very different experiences of what they have been going through in their life and what it's meant for them to follow on with God. So, Christine, can we start with you?
So this is a quote I carry around for myself in my work diary from The Shack Reflections by W.M. Paul Young. I feel it's very deep and poignant, and I might just read it twice so you can take it in a bit more. Sometimes I forget you are God of the darkness as much as God of the light. Help me not to light my own fires in the midst of darkness, but to press in further, to allow uncertainty to push me deeper into trust. I'm just going to read that again because it is quite a lot to take in, and even if I read it twice, you probably still won't get it. Sometimes I forget you are God of the darkness as much as God of the light. Help me not to light my own fires in the midst of dark times, but to press in further, to allow uncertainty to push me deeper into trust. So Sally asked me to talk about a time when I'd wrestled with God, and there's been quite a few of these, and I think more, not less, as I get older and experience what has happened in my life and in the life of others. Life comes with its shares of struggles and sorrows, and as Christians we're not immune to that. So how do we cope when God does not appear to answer the prayers in the way we want in our lives and others? When a loving, all-powerful God could step in and intervene, and he appears not to, or give us the answers that we want and think best. I started my current job in 2015, and I was on trust induction with the chaplaincy manager, and I can remember talking to him and probably quite cheekily saying to him, I'd like to do your job, but I expect I'd need some sort of religious qualification to do that. But there began a journey between me actually and Richard, who was the trust chaplain, was part of that because we worked in the same part of the building, so we'd often meet and catch up and have chats about things. But studying's now very expensive. I managed to find a part-time evening course at St Albans Abbey that fitted around my full-time job and caring responsibilities. So what I'd do is I'd finish a day at work And then I'd hang around in the office at St Albans. I'd take a ready meal and cook that. And then I'd head off to the Abbey for the course to start at 8 o'clock in the evening. I'm a resentful studier. I'm dyslexic, I'm not a natural academic, and I don't like it. Does not come easy, and I spent many a weekend or Christmas break writing essays and reading when I'd rather be out doing other things. I gave up my time and money to complete the course, which took about 4 years in the end because it was various part-time modules. In March 2019, I had the opportunity to do a two-day secondment to the chaplaincy team. So I was interviewed for the job and I got it. During that time, over almost a year, I covered 5 inpatient units and 1 day hospital. And I was due to finish in March 2020. That was when the secondment came to the end with the aim of applying for the job when advertised. I didn't make it till the end of March 2020, as the pandemic hit. And I volunteered to leave early to return full time to my previous post, as I felt my clinical skills were needed there. I was also almost finished my certificate in theology. I had one module away from completing it, but that all changed with the pandemic as well. So I applied for the chaplaincy job when it was advertised later that summer, though it wasn't certain I would get it. I think me, the chaplaincy manager, and the chaplaincy team expected me to. I didn't get it. And I can remember Richard's exact words were, "In normal circumstances, the job would have been yours." And I still don't know what he fully meant by that, and maybe I should ask him, but this led me to question what was not normal. And I thought maybe the COVID pandemic, but then I reasoned it's not as if God didn't know that the pandemic would hit. Revelation 22:13 tells us he's the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. It wasn't just myself who was disappointed. Others shared it with me. A lot of people had been involved in the process. In job 2021, the job was re-advertised. Yet again, I applied. Yet again, I was unsuccessful, though this time I probably understood more as the timing was not right. And I know I didn't interview well, as I was still in a state of grief after losing my mum. So, how do we manage these times when it hurts and things don't work out the way we want, when God doesn't appear to answer our prayers the way we want? So my first bit of advice is to tell God how you're feeling. He knows anyway, so you may as well be honest and just give him your pain and anger. I've had some very honest conversations with God saying, "I don't know, I don't understand, it's not fair, and it hurts." God doesn't always move in the way we want or at the speed we want. I still do not know or understand why it didn't work out. But we have to trust his plans and his knowledge that his plans are greater than ours and his promises are true, and hold on to what we know. Hebrews 11 tells us, "Now faith is confident in not what we hope for." So, read this properly. "Now, faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see." Wren Collective, in their song "Weep With Me," state, "What's true in the light is true in the dark. You're good and you're kind and you care for this heart. I will wrestle with your heart and I won't let you go." So we need to hold on to what we know from the past, even when his presence seemed distant. He doesn't answer our prayers the way we want, and we don't understand what's happening. And we sang Waymaker last week. Waymaker was a very significant song when I was doing the chaplaincy. And it comes with the lines that, "Even when I don't see it, you're working. Even when I don't feel it, you're working. You never stop, you never stop working. You are the way maker, miracle worker, promise keeper, light in the darkness. My God, that is who you are. So keep wrestling if that's where you are. Faith is forged in the challenging times where we receive the gifts of endurance, faith and courage. And I was thinking about this as I've very much concentrated on what it feels like if you're in it. But there's also a role for us when we might not be feeling like this, but we're supporting others who are. And I was trying to think what would that involve? And I think it involves standing alongside people. It involves helping them to be honest with God about how they're feeling. And if we don't know the answer, don't give it. Don't give trite answers when you don't know what the outcome is. It doesn't help. And sometimes it is about standing with them and going, I don't know, I don't understand either, but I know that God is feeling your pain and, you know, he is a God of his promises. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine. That is such an encouragement, isn't it, to us? Because what a tough place to be in and to keep trusting God through. You know, that's a tough call, isn't it? To keep following on when you're still not sure of what God's doing. You know, that is such a valuable testimony for us to encourage us to do the same. Thank you, Christine. And now we're going to hear from Pauline, who is talking about her experience and the challenge in possibly a similar kind of circumstance, but very different way.
Well, I want to take you back many years to when I was 22, just finishing at Goldsmiths College and looking forward to my first teaching job. So I was studying English and drama and looking forward to working in a secondary school somewhere. I was going to a Baptist church then in Peckham, and one Sunday when I was there, I felt the Lord really speaking to me about a hymn that we had, one of these old hymns. Some of you might still remember it. One of the verses said, "New pastures are before me, which yet I have not seen." And I thought, gosh, God's speaking to me about that. New pastures. Yes, I'm stepping out in this new job. And I, in my ignorance, I interpreted it geographically. So I started applying for all these jobs in Devon and Edinburgh and far reaches of the country, which I knew nothing about. But I thought, well, if that's what, you know, God's saying, I'll try. Nothing, heard nothing, nothing came back. And I wasn't bad. I mean, I was quite a good teacher. I'd passed my teaching practice. I knew quite a lot about my subject. And nothing was happening, nothing at all. And then, out of the blue, I got a letter asking me for interview at a school in North London as an RE specialist. It was a job I hadn't applied for. And what happened was, someone I'd met had known that I was looking for my first teaching job and had recommended me to the head teacher. Now, in teaching these days, that shouldn't change anything because you have to, everyone has to be interviewed and asked exactly the same questions. But they had sent me a letter of invitation. So I rang up the person who'd recommended me and I was incredibly angry. Very angry indeed. And I said, what are you playing at? Recommending me for a job that I don't want. And, you know, he said, well, I thought you could do it. And I thought, no, this is ridiculous. So I was panicking. This testimony is also about prayer. Because when you're when you're going to take on something you're confident in and you feel you've been trained for, you don't pray that much. You don't pray wholeheartedly. You don't cry out to God for your first teaching job, because I thought, well, I'm good, I'll get one, and that's it. And so I wasn't crying out to God in prayer. But in this situation, oh dear me, did I start to pray. Because I thought it through, and I thought, I'll be there with other candidates who are trained as RE specialists. And there I was. I'll be standing up in front of a head teacher and an interview panel with no qualification in RE. Not wanting the job, and add that to the fact that it was actually a renowned school, one of the worst schools in North London. I found that out later. But I just felt like I was going as a lamb to the slaughter. I thought, I'm going to be embarrassed at this interview. What on earth am I going to say? What am I going to do? Anyway, I started to pray, and after a couple of days, I started to think that God might want this. And after 4 days praying, I felt that I should obey and I should go to the interview. I mean, if God didn't want it, then I wasn't going to get it, was I? And the chances were I wasn't going to get it anyway. So I decided I would go. But did I struggle? I really struggled with this. Because it was basically me not feeling I didn't have the resources to do it and feeling that this was a step too far for me. And I thought, well, I'm going to make a fool of myself. What on earth do I say? And the Lord said to me, tell the truth. So of course, I waited for this question to come. Why do you want to be an RE teacher? Because I'd never even considered it. And I thought, that question is going to come. And I am going to have to say what happened. So it ended up being a bit of a testimony. And I had to say, well, it is very surprising, isn't it, that someone who hasn't trained for RE should want this post. But I said, I am a person who prays. And I said, after initially being surprised when I got the letter, and that's an understatement, I said, I started to pray, and I felt that actually, with God's help, this is something I could do. And so I said, that is why I am here. I like kids. I like communicating to kids. I will give it my best shot. And I said, more to the point, if I don't get this job, I said, I feel that I should apply for other jobs teaching RE. So that's what I said. And I thought, well, they're going to shoot me down. I knew the head teacher wasn't a Christian because my contact in the school had told me that. And I thought, I have made an absolute fool of myself. But it was the truth. And I was honest. They asked me how I thought I'd get on in this school. And having walked the corridors just before I took the interview and seen the children strangling each other in the corridor and slamming doors in people's face, I thought, okay, this is hard. So I was honest again in my response to that. I said, I think it's a difficult school. But I said, I'm a person who won't give up easily. I said, I won't be in the job 2 weeks and then resign. I said, I will persevere. And I said, it is tricky, but these kids need teaching like any kids need teaching. And so what happened was, despite the other candidates being trained as an RE specialist, I got the job. This is crazy. I got a job I hadn't applied for. I applied for it afterwards. He said, oh, you've got to fill in the application for the job. And I said, fine. After I'd got it, I thought, yeah, I'll do it. And it was a subject that I hadn't had any education in. I was a Christian. I'd become a Christian at college. But when it came to Islam and Buddhism and all the other things, I had not a clue, really. Not a clue. And so it was a difficult place to be. And I hadn't chosen it, which meant, this testimony is about prayer as well, which meant I had to pray. There's no way I would have survived in Slaybrook High School without the Lord's help. So I had to cry out to God. It was incredibly hard. Every night I was studying until 12 midnight just to be prepared for my lessons the next day. And of course, when I tried to get up at 6 for prayer, I was all over the place. So I developed this idea that I would pray for an hour a day and I would fit prayer into my life, because I could never do this job if I didn't. And so what I used to do, normally I used to pray for an hour in the morning, but there's no way I had time after being up till midnight preparing. I couldn't do it. So I'd pray for 5 minutes in the morning, get on my bike, go to the school, and then whatever time I had had not had in the morning, I would make up for when I came back from school. So leaving at 4 o'clock with stacks of books to mark, I would come home and I would pray for the rest of the hour. If I had 5 minutes with God in the morning, I would have 55 minutes when I came in. And I kept up that hour a day, despite having to work harder than any other time in my life. But what happened was, and the reason I'm standing here really, is that when we obey God, even though I was rebellious and even though I didn't want it, and I could think of far easier places I could be teaching, nice little school in Devon, you know, would be lovely. Or the country, you know, nice village school. Anyway, I carried on. And God blessed me. I experienced the favor of God in that school. And I had difficult classes, but somehow, within a few weeks, the classes realized that I had a passion for God and for my subject. And kids used to say to me, Miss, you're quite a nice person. Why on earth did you want to teach RE? And I said, well, actually, I didn't really. But I thought God wanted me to, because I'm positive about my faith. And I used to tell the kids that every other subject in school prepares you for this life, but RE prepares you for the life to come. Ah, it reaches the place other subjects can't reach. And they, strangely enough, they accepted that. And they thought, okay, yeah, school is for life and RE is for something else, something extra. So God blessed me. And even in lessons that were about Buddhism and Islam, kids would ask me questions about what on earth made me be a Christian. And of course, as an RE teacher, you can't proselytize, that's the word. It means make converts. You're not really allowed to because you're an educator. But when a child asks a question, even though it's not part of my lesson plan, the fair thing to do is to give an answer. So I would take off my RE teacher's hat And I would tell them that I say some things as an RE teacher and I say other things as a Christian. And so I would literally swap hats and I would say, as an RE teacher, I would say I respect all religions. But as a Christian, I believe there's only one way to God. And I would say that to the children, that I wear two hats. And it's the only way I could balance having to teach what other faiths say and trying to share what I believed as well. So it was hard, but God was there. And I used to travel around with my husband sometimes when he was preaching, and we'd go to churches, and kids would, teenagers or people in their 20s would come up to me and they're saying, "Do you remember me? Because you taught me RE." And they would be there in church. So although I wasn't allowed to proselytize, the positive view of God and faith that the Lord allowed me to project reach people. And time again, I was finding out that they'd become a Christian when they were 19 or when they were 21 or when they were 25, and that God had reminded them of my lessons on the life of Jesus in year 9, and they said they'd never forgotten it, and they realized that God loved them even then, though they didn't respond at that time. So I'm still meeting up with people who sat through my RE lessons, and God's favor was there. Now, had I remained rebellious and had I said, "No, I like English, I'm going to teach English," none of that probably would have happened. I'm hoping God would have called someone else, but I don't know. So I was fulfilled in the place that God had for me. And all I can say is obedience is not this nasty thing that Sally mentioned. And we think of obedience, don't we, as something that a prison commandant says, "You will obey. We have ways of making you cooperate." It isn't like that. Obeying God is very different because it's what he wants for us. He's putting us in the place where he can use us and where we will be fulfilled. So the good news about obedience is, as we pray, God changes us. He makes us favorable to what God has chosen for us, and we move with it, and he blesses us in that.
Thank you. It's amazing, isn't it? Two very different circumstances. Pauline there, faced with something she didn't want, wasn't looking for, and God was asking her to take it up. And Pauline trusting God for that. And Christine, we heard earlier, who is still trusting God for the path forward, that something, for something that God hasn't yet brought to her. How he works differently in all our lives, but both those testimonies, ones of trust for the future. I'm going to hear the story of somebody now from a long time ago in our history as human beings, who took a bit of an opposite approach to that. And that person is Jacob. Now, Jacob had a twin brother, Esau. They were the twin boys of Rebekah and Isaac. And even before they were born, there were promises over those boys. There were promises over Jacob. Because Rebekah had been told, "You have two nations in your womb. The older one is going to serve the younger one. Now, Esau was the older one. He came out first. So he was entitled to the birthright, the inheritance, if you like, the blessing. And Jacob was the younger one. God had already said, the older will serve the younger. But Jacob, whose name actually means deceiver, decided he'd take things into his own hands. Thank you very much. He quite wanted to have the birthright. He quite wanted that blessing. And so he hatched a plan with his mother, I have to say, to deceive his father into giving him that. When his father was very ill, he dressed up as Esau. He pretended to be Esau. His father's eyesight wasn't that great, and he dressed and was clothed like Esau, and he took his father in a lovely meal. And his father said to him, he was a bit suspicious. He said to him, who is this? Who are you? And he said, I'm Esau. Father thought, well, he feels like Esau. He sounds a bit like Jacob. But he accepted he was Esau, and he prayed the blessing over him. And Jacob received Esau's blessing. Well, understandably, Esau was not thrilled about this and was very angry and plotted to kill Jacob once Isaac was dead. Mother overheard this and said to Jacob, you'd better get out, wait till the dust settles, wait till it's all calmed down, and then you can come back again. You go to my brother's house, your uncle, Laban, and he'll take you in. So that's what he did. And on the way, he has a dream. He recognizes it's God speaking to him. God tells him he'll have many descendants. The peoples of the earth will be blessed through him and his children. God himself will be with him wherever he goes. He says, I will watch over you. I'll bring you back to this land. The promise is still over Jacob. So he's had his encounter with God. But he arrives at Laban's place, and he spends 20 years there. He marries the two daughters of Laban. They have a family. But life isn't great. It's very stressful. There's family arguments. There's quarreling amongst his two wives. There's quarreling with Laban about who owns what. The business arrangement doesn't go well. He feels deceived by Laban. He doesn't feel he's treated well. And it culminates in a bit of a bust-up where he decides to leave. And he's going to go back to his own place, his own land. So he leaves with his family, his herdsmen, his cattle, his livestock, and off he goes back. But there's a problem. Esau's going to be there. He doesn't know how Esau is going to react to him. So he sends a message ahead. Let Esau know I'm coming. And the message comes back. Esau's coming to meet you with 400 men. He is terrified. And he sends everybody ahead. And he's alone on his own, and he prays. While he's praying, it says, there was a man that wrestled with him all night. He was in a big struggle here. And the man says to him, what is your name? When has he been asked that question before? It was when Isaac had asked him the question, when he was deceiving him, "Who are you?" And he had said, "I'm Esau." This time, the man was asking him in his wrestling, and he said, "I'm Jacob. Jacob, the deceiver." Finally, he'd been honest. He was having to face up to his past. He was having to face up to who he was, Jacob, the deceiver. And the man said to him, "You're going to be called something else. You're being called the one who wrestled with God and who wrestled with man and who has overcome." God was still faithful. He had a new name, a new identity in that place of facing himself. But the really sad thing about his story is that he tried to take on and produce his own future. When God had already promised it to him, he took it into his own hands. And because of that, he had that 20 years in exile and had to come back. He could have missed out those 20 years if he had trusted God for what God had said in the first place. Now, when it comes to us, you know, with obedience, first of all, we have to think, well, who are we going to be obedient to? Who are we going to follow? Who are we going to trust? You know, are we going to try and produce our own answers, like Jacob? Or are we going to follow the example of Pauline and Christine and trust God in that place? We need to know what our options are. Now, Jacob had his promises, but there are promises for all of us. There are promises over the lives of all of us. Now, unless we know what the promises are that God has for us, how can we choose them? How can we make a choice if we don't know what half the choice is? So if you're here today and or listening and you don't know what the promises are, we'd love to hear you and to explain what some of those promises are so that you know what you have to choose from. Otherwise, excuse me, I've had a bit of a cold this week, so I'm still a bit snivelly. Otherwise, if somebody, you know, if Graham says to me, "What do you want for tea?" I need to know what's in the fridge, you know, because otherwise I don't know what I'm going to choose. So if we don't know what God says about us and what he's promising us, how can we choose it? So we need to know that first. And secondly, then, we need to know, if I'm choosing to follow God, if I want to do that, how do I know out of all the voices, out of all the influences that I'm hearing, how do I know which one is him? And in a few weeks' time, Josh is going to be speaking to us about that. He's going to be helping us with how we hear what is God, what isn't God, so that we can follow that on. And lastly, maybe there are things a bit like Jacob that we need to face up to. Maybe we have gone our own way. Maybe it's not turned out as God would have intended. Maybe there are things that we've done that we need to face up to, just like Jacob did.